You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Justice Lit. We are back with another episode of the Sonnet series. We finished off Sonnet 81. We did quite a bit, and I'm surprised how much we have progressed on, but we finished Sonnet 73 last episode, and so we will start off with Sonnet 74 today. But other than that, not much is going on, but actually not 74, we'll be starting Sonnet 75 today. But the weather has been great lately, and so I hope everyone has been taking advantage of the sunshine. But, you know, the past couple of weeks, I've just been going on a lot of walks. Finals and everything are over now, and so kind of just enjoying the moment of no school and assignments. But other than that, it's been pretty mediocre. How have you guys been doing? You know, I'm kind of wondering. But, yeah, without further talking, I think we're going to start off with the readings after some ads, show poems and PSAs, and our first song of the day from Rhonda Head called From Afar. So we'll be listening to some ads, show poems and PSAs, and then this From Afar, and then we'll get right into the readings. We'll be right back.
What are you doing?
I love CITR 0.0.9 FM.
CITR
1.0.1.9 FM. What are you doing? If you're not listening to Planet and it flows to non CITR 1.9 FM every other Tuesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific.
What a beautiful day.
Yeah.
Are you hungry? I think I'm hungry. I think we should get ourselves something nice for our beach day.
Oh yeah?
Oh my god, I know the perfect place. Cockney King's Fish and Chips is literally just around the corner. We should go there. It is the best fish and chips in Vancouver.
Oh my god, yes, absolutely. Let's go right now.
Cockney King's Fish and Chips, Kitsilano. On Cornwall Avenue, between Cypress and Walnut. It's the best fish and chips in town. But don't take our word for it. Try it yourself. If Kitsilano isn't your neighborhood, check out Cockney King's in Burnaby or New Westminster.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the Indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Thank you.
it's really hard to do. I love you from afar, from afar, from afar.
And we are back. You just finished listening to some ads, show and promos and PSAs, and From Afar by Rhonda Head. So we're going to start off with Sonnet 75. So are you to my thoughts as food to life, or as sweet seasoned showers are to the ground. And for the peace of you I hold such strife, as twixt a miser and his wealth is found. Now proud as an enjoyer, and anon, doubting the flinching age will steal his treasure, now counting best to be with you alone, then better that the world may see my pleasure. Sometime all full with feasting on your sight, and by clean starved for a look, possessing or pursuing no delight, save what is had or must from you be took. Thus do I pine and surfeit day by day, or gluttoning on all or all away. So Sonnet 75... compares himself, the poet here compares himself to a miser with his treasure. He finds the beloved so essential to his life that he lives in a constant tension between glorifying in that treasure and fearing its loss. And so if we go to lines 1 and 2, here the speaker begins with giving us some similes that compare the beloved to food for thought and rain for the earth, which is essential and nourishing and deeply sustaining. And the comparison suggests the vital necessity of the beloved, not just for a want, but a need for psychological and emotional survival. For lines 3 and 4, to read it out, and for the peace of you I hold such strife, as twixt the miser and his wealth is found. Here he shifts from nourishment to an internal conflict, which is his desire for peace in the beloved's presence, and how that's consistently interrupted by a miser-like anxiety about possessing and losing. And so the image of the miser introduces the idea and ideas of possessiveness and also greed and a fearful attachment. Lines 5 and 6. Here we get a kind of a twist, a little swing in the speaker's emotions, where sometimes he rejoices in love, and other times he fears its loss, especially to time. And we see that in the phrase, the flinching age. And so we see a personification of time as a thief, which is a reoccurring motive in a lot of these sonnets, and that how that emphasizes love's vulnerability. Lines 7 and 8... we see a bit of a vacillation between private joy and public pride. And at times, the speaker wants intimacy, and at others, he wants to show off the relationship. And that suggests the dual desire for both privacy and validation. With lines 9 and 10... we are provided with more metaphors that relate to feasting and famine. So if I read it out loud, sometime all full with feasting on your sight, and by clean, starved for a look. And so here the speaker swings between visual abundance, which is seen by feasting, and deprivation in starvation, which intensifies the intensifies the emotional instability. And so we could see that the beloved's mere appearance becomes a source of consumption. With lines 11 and 12, so here all joy is centered on the beloved. And whether he has them or is chasing them, no other delight compares. And the verbs had and took, these verbs suggest both passive reception and active desire, and shows a complicated dynamic between contentment and craving. The last two couplets, the sonnet here then closes with an oxymoronic excess and lack, and that's seen in the phrase pine and surfeit, which basically means pine, waste away, and surfeit, overindulge. And also gluttoning on all versus having all away, having which means all away. And these extremes of emotions show that love is unstable and how love is consuming and also paradoxical in a sense, that kind of convey both torment and ecstasy. And so that was Sonnet 75. We'll move on to Sonnet 76. Why is my verse so barren of new pride, so far from variation or quick change? Why with the time do I not glance aside to newfound methods and to compound strange? Why write I still all one, ever the same, and keep invention to a noted weed, in a noted weed, that every word doth almost tell my name, showing their birth and where they did proceed? Oh no, sweet love, I always write of you, and you and love are still my argument. So all my best is dressing old worlds new, spending again what is already spent. For as the sun is daily new and old, so is my love still telling what is told. Now here, the poet poses the question of why his poetry never changes, but keeps repeating the same language and technique. And the answer, he says, is that his theme never changes, and he always writes of the beloved and of love. With the two lines, the first two lines, the speaker opens up with a self-interrogation, questioning why his poetry lacks novelty, of new pride or stylistic innovation, hence variation or quick change. And the word barren suggests both creative infertility and an almost moral emptiness, introducing a tension between aesthetic value and artistic self-worth. With lines 3 and 4, he contrasts his consistency with literary trends, and the quote, "with the time," signals a contemporary fashion or poetic experimentation. The phrase "compound strange," in a sense, would imply artificial poetic devices or forced metaphors, perhaps referencing the elaborate conceits of other poets, possibly even a gentle jab at the metaphysical style. And he also resists the symbols, implying they are superficial or transient. With lines 5 to 6, these lines continue the lament of sameness, and the quote, "all one," emphasizes a lack of stylistic variation. The phrase "invention in a noted weed" is particularly rich, where weed here means garment, and noted suggests something familiar or previously recognized. The speaker is also dressing his poetic invention, creativity in a sense, in the same clothes, and this could be seen as a metaphor for stylistic repetition. With lines 7 and 8, we are provided with a moment of a double-edged sword, or double-edged pride, I should say, and the speaker's style is so distinctive that his poems are recognizably his. But we can also see an ambivalence, where this recognizability might suggest predictability. And the phrase birth and proceed will imply origin, meaning each word reveals not just his identity, but his inspiration. In other words, his muse. With lines 9 to 10, we are presented with the volta, and so we kind of shift from anxiety to explanation. And the reason for this, or his poetic sameness, is revealed in the volta. His constant theme for love, or more precisely the beloved, that is all revealed. And the phrase argument here means both subject and rationale. And it's not that he lacks new material, but his fidelity to one subject is intentional and heartfelt. We got the volta a bit quickly compared to other sonnets, but lines 11 to 12. Here he admits to recycling language, but there's a craft and affection in it. And the phrase dressing old words new implies refreshing rather than repeating. The phrase spending again introduces a metaphor of poetic currency, which values lies not in originality, but in expressive sincerity. And so we get that. The final couplet, for as the sun is daily new and old, so is my love still telling what is told. Now, the closing couplet offers a metaphor that is natural. The sun appears both constant and ever-renewing, and through this, in the same way, his beloved is timeless but always experienced afresh. And the phrase, still telling what is told, embraces repetition as a form of truth rather than limitation. Moving on to sonnet 77. Thy glass will show thee how thy beauties wear, thy dial how thy precious minutes waste, the vacant leaves thy mind's imprint will bear, and of this book this yearning mayest thou taste. The wrinkles which thy glass will truly show of mouthed graves will give thee memory, that by thy dial's shady stealth mayest know time's thievest progress to eternity. Look what thy memory cannot contain, commit to these waste blanks, and thou shalt find those children nursed, delivered from thy brain, to take a new acquaintance of thy mind. These offices, so oft as thou wilt look, shall profit thee and much enrich thy book. Now this sonnet seems to have been written to accompany the gift of a blank notebook. The poet encourages the beloved to write down the thoughts that arise from observing a mirror and sundial and the lessons they teach about the brevity of life. To analyze lines 1 to 4, I guess the mirrors and the clocks and the blank pages are significant to consider in these four lines. The phrase, thy glass, refers to a mirror, which shows how beauty fades with time. And the phrase, thy dial, refers to a sundial of timepiece or timepiece, showing how one's minutes, which could be seen as life, pass by and are wasted in the sense of being used up. The phrase, the vacant leaves, evoke the blank pages of a notebook or book, which is the literal object in which the poet suggests the addressee write. And we see a shift from a passive observation through the mirror and clock to active inscription to the from the mirror or writing thoughts. And the phrase mind's imprint suggests that inner thoughts leave traces on the page And this act of externalizing the mind becomes a form of learning, both a record and a mirror of thought. With lines 5 and 8, the mirror reveals wrinkles, which are emblems of aging, and becomes a memento mori, and that triggers the remembrance of quote-unquote mouthed graves, a haunting phrase that personifies death as a devouring force. The phrase shady stealth reinforces the idea of time as a silent thief, moving unnoticed, taking youth and life. And we are also provided with a paradox in the phrase time's thievish progress in eternity. And here, time, which seems to steal life, also leads to eternity, perhaps suggesting immortality via remembrance or written legacy. With lines 9 to 12, we are provided with a shift in tone, and so how it's now a directive to write, and what memory cannot hold should be committed to quote-unquote waste banks, and this is waste banks is basically empty pages. This metaphor of writing as birthing and nursing children from the mind ultimately suggests a creative or an intellectual legacy. And once again, these children return to the mind differently, and how they're encountered anew, showing how writing mediates between thought and self-reflection. The final couplet is, in a sense, the benefit of, kind of deals with the benefit of revisiting writing. And the phrase, these offices, refer to the acts of writing, or remembering or rereading, and revisiting what one has written becomes a form of self-education, which enriches both the book and the mind of the reader. And that was Sonnet 77. And before we move on to 78, I have one more song for you guys, and it's called Up Where We Belong by Rhonda Head. So we'll be right back after this. Here we go. Thank you. Welcome back. That was Up Where We Belong by Rhonda Head, and we will move into Sonnet 78. So oft have I invoked thee for my muse, and found such fair assistance in my verse. And every alien pen hath got my muse, and under thee their poesy disperse. Thine eyes that taught me the dumb on high to sing, and heavy ignorance aloft to fly, have added feathers to the learned wing, and given grace a double majesty. Yet be most proud of that which I compile, whose influence is thine and born of thee. In others, works thou dost but mend the style, and arts with thy sweet graces graced be. But thou art all my art and dost advance, as high as learning my rude ignorance. Now here, the poet seems to express his concern that others are writing verses praising the beloved, and the other poets are presented as learned and skillful, and thus in no need of the beloved, in contrast to the poet speaking here. So to kind of look into lines 1 to 4, we see the beloved as a muse to many. And the speaker opens up with a confession. He has often called upon the beloved as his muse. And the phrase "invoked thee for my muse" places the beloved in the, classical tradition of poetic inspiration, like the invocation of the muse in epic poetry. The second line, "found such fair assistance," suggests that the speaker's poetry has improved thanks to this inspiration. But we also see a shift in tone with the lines 3 and 4, where the speaker notes that, quote-unquote, every alien pen, seen as other poets, have begun to draw on the same source, benefiting from the beloved's inspiration as he has. And the metaphor of poetry being dispersed under the beloved suggests a kind of poetic contagion or influence. as if the muse has become a shared resource. With lines 5 to 8, here we see the beloved's uplifting power. And so these lines elevate the beloved's power to almost a divine status. The eyes are not merely beautiful. They are actually, quote-unquote, taught the dumb on high to sing and lifted heavy ignorance into flight. And so these metaphors suggest that the beloved just doesn't inspire existing talent, but transforms ignorance into a knowledge and silence into song. Moving on to lines 9 to 12. Here we kind of differentiate the speaker's verse, and the volta is also present here. So the speaker shifts from a describing of the beloved's general influence to asserting the uniqueness of his own poetry. And he suggests that his poems are not merely improved by the beloved, but are entirely born of him. Moving on to the final couplet, this is, in a sense, a culmination of the beloved is all my art, meaning that he's not just a muse, but the entirety of the poetic and poet's skill, knowledge and creativity. And the phrase advance my rude ignorance suggests that without the beloved, the speaker is unlearned, perhaps raw, even incapable of producing poetry. And so the beloved transforms ignorance into learning, bringing the speaker into the heights of artistic expression. Moving on to Sonnet 79, whilst I alone did call upon thy aid, my verse alone had all thy gentle grace. But now my gracious numbers are decayed, and my sick muse doth give another place. I grant, sweet love, thy lovely argument deserves the travail of worthier pen. Yet what of thee thy poet doth invent, he robs thee of and pays it thee again. He lends thee virtue, and he stole that word from thy behavior. Beauty doth he give, and found it in thy cheek. He can afford no praise to thee, but what in thee doth live. Then thank him not for that which he doth say, since what he owes thee, thou thyest dost pay. Now in this sonnet, it follows directly from Sonnet 78. And that the poet laments the fact that another poet has taken his place, just like the sonnet before. Yet he urges the beloved to recognize that all of the beauty and grace and virtue found in the rival's praise is taken from the beloved, so that the rival deserves no thanks or appreciation. With lines 1 to 4, the phrase, "Whilst I alone did call upon thy aid," here the speaker reflects on a time when he alone wrote poetry inspired by the beloved. And the phrase, "My verse alone had all thy gentle grace," here his poetry uniquely captured the beloved's qualities. He was the sole poetic voice rendering their beauty. The phrase, "But now my gracious numbers are decayed," the speaker laments a decline in his poetry, being a term for poetic lines or meter, implying that his work has now lost all vitality. With lines 5 to 8, the phrase, "I grant sweet love," the speaker concedes that the beloved's beauty is worthy of better poetry than his. And travail of a worthier pen, which is a more skillful poet, may now be attempting to capture the beloved's virtues. With lines 9 to 12, we are presented with a paradox of praise to be in particular. And here the phrase, "he lends the virtue," signals the rival in a sense seeming to give compliments, but he is merely returning what he has taken. And the phrase stolen, stole that word from thy behavior, the idea of virtue comes directly from the beloved's actions, not the poet's invention. Now, the phrase beauty in thy cheek, even beauty is not poetic creativity, but it originates in the beloved's own appearance. And let's see here. The phrase no praise, but what in thee doth live? All poetic praise is just a reflection, and the poet creates something new. The last couplet, we see that the beloved should not thank the rival poet, because any poet he offers is borrowed from their inherent qualities. And we see a kind of a instance where poetic is being served justice, and the beloved is both the inspiration and the source of repayment for poetic admiration. Or not the poetic being served justice, kind of a poetic theme of justice. Moving on to Sonnet 80. Oh, how I faint when I of you do write, knowing a better spirit doth use your name, and in the praise thereof spends all his might to make me tongue-tied speaking of your fame. But since your worth wide as the ocean is, the humble as the proudest sail doth bear, my saucy bark, inferior far to his, on your broad main doth willfully appear. Your shallowest help will hold me up afloat, whilst he upon your soundless deep doth ride, or being racked I am a worthless boat, he of tall building and of goodly pride. Then if he strive and I be cast away, the worst was this, my love was my decay. Now here the poet admits his inferiority to the one who is now writing about the beloved, portraying the two poets as ships sailing on the ocean of the beloved's worth, the rival poet as large and splendid, and himself as a small boat that risks being wrecked by love. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins with a confession of weakness, and how he faints when he writes of the beloved, because he is painfully aware that another, a better spirit, is writing about the same person more powerfully. And we see a tension between desire and inadequacy, where he wants to praise the beloved but feels eclipsed by his superior poet. So we can see with Sonnet 78, 79, 80, we are dealing with a bit of jealousy or anxious awareness of a poet or a person that is more superior to the speaker. With lines 5 and 8, the beloved's worth is wide as the ocean, and this metaphor suggests an immense capacity to inspire and sustain many admirers, regardless of their status or skill. And both the humble and the proudest sail are carried on this ocean, and this implies generosity or capaciousness in the beloved. Lines 9 to 12. Here, even the shallowest help from the beloved is enough to keep the sailor afloat. And this humble request, in a sense, contrasts with the rival's confident voyage on the soundless deep. And this is an image of poetic mastery, of profound connection. Moving on to the lines 13, 14, the last couplet. Here, the closing couplet delivers a poignant conclusion, where if the rival succeeds and the speaker fails, it was his very love that caused his downfall. And we also see a tragic nobility here, where the speaker accepts the consequences of love greatly, even if it leads to a personal ruin. Moving on to Sonnet 81. Sonnet 81. Or I shall live your epitaph to make, or you survive when I in earth am rotten. From hence your memory death cannot take, although in me each part will be forgotten. Your name from hence immortal life shall have, though I once gone to all the world must die. The earth can yield me but a common grave, when you entombed in men I shall lie. Your monument shall be my gentle verse, which eyes not yet created shall overread, and tongues to be your being shall rehearse, when all the breathers of this world are dead. You still shall live, such virtue hath in my pen, where breath most breathes, even in mouths of men. Now here the poet imagines a future in both he and the beloved are dead, and he sees himself as being completely forgotten, while the beloved will be forever remembered because of the poet's verse. So in lines 1 to 4, the speaker imagines two possibilities. Either he will outlive the beloved and write their epitaph, or the beloved will outlive him. And regardless of who dies first, the speaker insists that the beloved's memory is protected from the death. With lines 5 to 8, the speaker's poetic act grants the beloved's name immortality. And the use of immortal life implies not bodily survival, but a continued presence in cultural memory. And the poet will also receive no grand monument, only a common grave, which is a humbling image of anonymity in death. With lines 9 to 12, here the monument to the beloved is not made of stone, but of gentle verse. And the adjective gentle softens the image of grandeur, suggesting an affection and emotional intimacy. And even after the current generation has perished, the future tongues, voices, and languages will rehearse the beloved's being. The final couplet kind of affirms the central claim. The beloved shall live due to the virtue and power of excellence of the poet's pen. And the beloved will continue to live in the quote-unquote mouths of men, a compelling image of legacy via recitation. Moving on to Sonnet 82, I grant thou wert not married to my muse, and therefore mayest without a taint to overlook the dedicated words which writers use of their fair subject, blessing every book. Thou art as fair in knowledge as in hue, finding thy worth a limit past my praise, and therefore art enforced to speak anew some fresher stamps of the time-bettering days, and do so love yet when they have devised what strange touches rhetoric can lend. Thou truly fair wert truly sympathized in true plain words by thy true-telling friend, and their gross painting might be better used, where cheeks need blood in thee it is abused. Now, in this sonnet, the poet again addresses the fact that other poets write in praise of the beloved, so kind of a continuation, but the beloved is free to read them, but their poems do not represent the beloved truly. And so here, lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins with a concession, where the beloved is not bound, which is not married, exclusively to his poetic voice. And we can see that in the phrase, my muse. And this metaphor of marriage implies a deep, almost sacred artistic relationship. And because of this, the beloved is free to overlook or read critically the effusive language other poets use to glorify their subjects. And moving on to lines 5 and 8, the beloved here is praised for being equally beautiful in mind and appearance. And the speaker says the beloved's worth exceeds what he can express, so much so that the beloved is enforced compelled even to speak or seek more fresher poetic voices. And so there's both admiration and a hint of resignation here. Also raising a question of, is the beloved turning more towards fashionable or perhaps more insincere writers? So is the beloved turning toward more fashionable, perhaps more insincere writers? So that's worthy of thinking about here. With lines 9 to 12, here the speaker gives permission, but pivots with the quote-unquote yet, signaling contrast. And so with this, we can kind of further analyze. The speaker contrasts this with his own poetic voice, true plain words from a true telling friend. And so this characterization evokes sincerity and honesty and emotional authenticity. And the word sympathized implies deep emotional understanding, not just a surface level praise. The final couplet, we are concluding with a bit of a bite. The phrase gross painting refers to heavy-handed artificial embellishment, which could be seen as a makeup or gaudy language. And the metaphor implies that such rhetorical excess would be better used to give color to something or someone lacking it. In the phrase, where cheeks need blood, and not someone naturally beautiful like the beloved. And so with this, we can conclude that in praising the beloved with excessive ornamentation, these poets actually do a disservice, and they distort what is already perfect. And that was Sonnet 82. And we have hit the end of our show today. We kind of went over a bunch of sonnets, 75 to 82. And so we will continue on with 83 next week. But today we'll wrap it up here. Yeah, that's the end. Thank you all for joining Jess is Lit, and I'll see you guys again next Wednesday at 11 a.m. And have yourselves a great rest of the day and the rest of your week. And I will see you guys again soon. Thank you all. Bye-bye.